Godspeed with Carol Hollenbeck, Sundays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Carol Hollenbeck. Dr. Yannis Tousselis is the author of Sufism and the Way of Blame, Hidden Sources of a Sacred Psychology, and he currently serves as director of ITLAC Foundation, AIWP, a non-denominational religious nonprofit dedicated to Sufi studies. Dr. Tousselis formerly served as an adjunct professor in political psychology at the Monterey Institute of International Studies and was also director of the Consciousness Program, Antioch University West. Dr. Tousselis, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Now, I'd like to begin, actually, with your book, which has been called a definitive book on the Sufi way of blame, that addresses the cultural life of Sufism in its entirety. Dr. Stanley Krippner says it surpasses any book on the topic currently in print and calls it an authoritative volume and one badly needed at this time. Can we begin there? I'd like to ask, from your experience, what led you and what culminated to inspire you to write your book at this time?
Well, what culminated in the book was 30 years of experience traveling the Sufi path, and also my background, which was and still is in psychology and consciousness studies. I've been a teacher and adjunct professor in the area of consciousness studies for approximately 35 years. That academic background plus my own inspiration led me to take up meditative practices fairly early in my life. And that led me, in turn, to the path of Sufism about 30 years ago. So my inspiration in writing this book was based on a long background of experience in meditative techniques and in Sufism in particular. On the path, so-called path of blame, we have to be careful with that term because it doesn't really mean what it seems to mean, is a very small school within general Sufism. I was led to that in 1995 and became involved with it experientially myself.
Now, it's a very small school, but it's a rather ancient one. If you could share a little bit, first a little more in general about Sufism and specifically about the way of blame.
Well, the simplest way to define Sufism is the mysticism of Islam. Sufism definitely is nested within the larger tradition of Islam. And the Malami or the Malami path or way of blame is nested within Sufism. So all three are like nesting boxes, so to speak. The tradition of the Malamiya, as it's called in Arabic, goes back to 9th century Nishapur, Iran. At that time, of course, called Persia, the northeastern province of Persia. It moved forward and was revived by the 14th century in Ottoman Turkey, and then the so-called third wave of Malami activity took place at the close of the 19th century, from the mid-19th to the close of the 19th century.
And why is it called the Way of Blame?
This is, of course, an important question. The word malam, or blame, has several meanings in Arabic. Self-blame is the first meaning, and by self-blame, we shouldn't pause to think of that as self-condemnation. We should think of it rather as synonymous with being conscientious. In other words, developing a conscience, having a conscience, and in the interest of that conscious, developing one's spirituality. So blame, the best way to translate the word less literally, is conscientiousness.
So it's not utilized in the way we would be using it when we speak about blame and sort of pointing fingers at another for some source of pain or error. It's it's holding oneself and developing oneself within.
Right. The paradox, or perhaps even the irony in all this, is that as one develops this particular form of conscientiousness, blame falls away. One becomes blameless. And that is a paradox. The deeper one's conscience, the more one rids oneself of superfluous blame, superfluous guilt.
Now, can you share a little more about that? Because that's a rather important point, because that's probably where most of our culture tends to rest, is on superfluous.
The Protestant theologian Paul Tillich pointed out some years ago in The Courage to Be, a book that he's well known for, that there are two forms of shame or blame. One is neurotic blame. That is, that one dwells on past mistakes, well, actually present or past mistakes, and ruminates continuously about what one could have done, should have done, etc. The type of conscientiousness that I'm speaking of doesn't do that. It notices, it's acutely morally responsible on the one hand, and sheds excessive or neurotic blame as it probes what needs to be done.
Superfluous blame or guilt for present or past actions, it's basically a life of regret. Or, and that in itself, I think, some might consider immoral.
Well, yeah, because often it stands in as a substitute for direct action, for rectifying what one has done, or what one will do if one doesn't take a different path of action. It's sort of like, for those of us who've been Catholic, and I'm not Catholic, but I have close Catholic friends, it's sort of like constantly dwelling on the mea culpas.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I understand that, and I'm sure many do as well. I've been known to say, because it's a favorite definition of mine out of the Catholic community, definition of sin, going back to the 4th century, Gregory of Nyssa, who defined sin as merely refusal to grow.
Yeah,
It's not necessarily focused on the mistakes, but on that whatever needs to move forward.
I think that's at the center of the path of blame as well. It's to confront the refusal to grow, the refusal to take the necessary risks that are entailed in self-transformation.
So what did they do, this group back in the 9th century? How did it actually become lived out, and was there any particular person involved, a key figure?
The key figure is Hamdun Kassar. The path of the Malamia was different than the rest of Sufism, insofar it was more psychological, more inward-turning and psychological and investigative. What they did differently was they focused on silent meditation and a process called in Arabic muhasabah, or self-reckoning. That is, every day they would recount what they did, and they would confront the nature of their own actions as part of their practice. So muhasabe, the practice of self-reckoning, was very important to the Malamatis or Malamis, even and more so than most Sufis, who cultivated states of ecstasy and sometimes, according to the Malamati school, became overly concerned with excessive, ostentatious display of spirituality.
Mm. Yes, so, and I imagine spirituality is more of a modern word that we use rather generally. in our culture today. You referred to this as a sacred psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And would they have focused more on, let's say, the psychology of egoism?
Yes, on something called the states and stations. That is, where one's ego identification is the strongest. And investigating that fixation,
and having developing a practice to shed those attachments or practices of egoism.
Correct.
Keeping each other in check.
Yeah. The two solvents used were what we would call now meditation, deep meditation, but also this relentless self-reckoning. Facing one's shadow side, one could say.
Oh, yes, the shadow side. Mm-hmm. That comes up almost across the board when we discuss the religions, as well as the image of the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
Across all mystical traditions, there's the mirror, the clear mirror that needs polishing, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what differentiates them, say, from other Sufi groups or orders that were to come or that followed?
Several things. First of all, the way of blame focused on blending in with one's natural surroundings and with one's society so that one didn't stick out as a person that was particularly religious. The early Malamatiya or Malamiya was acutely aware of the tendency of people to inflate their spiritual states and to express them in a manner that's ostentatious and often hypocritical.
Mm.
So they focused on not sticking out from anyone else, of blending with the crowd, of being unnoticeable. That's one thing that marked them as different. By extension, they avoided any signs of exterior signs, that is, of Sufi affiliation. They didn't wear special clothing, and many of the Sufi orders do. They did not perform zikr or the practice of remembrance, which is a form of meditation, often vocalized. They didn't perform it outwardly. They performed it inwardly, quietly, so no one would notice that they were practicing.
Hmm.
They also never performed supererogatory exercises, religious exercises. They stuck to, you could say, the bare minimum necessary, at least in anything that would be shown outwardly. They were also highly suspicious of inflated spiritual states, so they tended to be more on the sober end of the spectrum than the typical intoxicated Sufism that we're more familiar with.
Right.
Psychological grounding from the beginning was very important to them. Realism, psychological grounding, and confronting one's own hypocrisy in making any kind of statement about one's own development or perfection in any form of spiritual state.
Now, that's very interesting. Thank you for that answer. It almost seems this is a form of spirituality that, you know, more people could live almost in daily life. But when we talk about Sufism, or in general, we tend to focus on the mystical aspect of it only. And as, of course, you know, people tend to refer to, you know, few sources here in the West, usually generally Rumi. But there is more to Sufism than just the mystical aspect of it. It's a multiplex phenomena, as you use your phrase. Can you share a little more about the different dimensions of it? Because I think that would be very interesting to hear about for our listeners.
Well, one way of schematizing this is to reflect on the belief that there are three cornerstones represented by three of the great Sufis, three cornerstones of Sufism. One is the way of love, which has been represented beautifully in North America through the translation of Jalaluddin Rumi's poetry.
Yeah.
The way of love is often accented in translations, or at least approaches to Sufism in North America. But the other equally important approach to Sufism is the way of knowledge. the way of knowledge is best represented by a 12th century figure named Muhyiddin Ibn al-Arabi, who developed a very deep and very sophisticated metaphysics. The third cornerstone is efficacy, that is, being efficacious in the world, of exhibiting the right kind of action in the world, which is moral action. And that's represented by one of the great savants of Sufism, Al-Gilani, or Al-Jilani, depending on your pronunciation. So the way of efficacy, the way of knowledge, and the way of love must be united in order for there to be a completed Sufism.
And the efficacy at its core, it sounds like, is going to have the source of compassion.
Compassion and ethics.
And ethics. Yeah.
Moral action is the way I would describe it.
Okay.
That is, that one doesn't just sit still for injustice in the world, and one does not sit still for acts of injustice that one oneself commits, but one attempts to rectify those actions, that behavior. It's very much analogous to what Buddhists call skillful means, the development of skillful means.
Now, in your work, you recognize that the human being requires meaning, and of course meaning is completely cross-cultural and personal as well, and you call it a coherent pattern of values to live by, but that it does not necessitate the adoption of a doctrinaire system of fixed beliefs. Could you please share this important point regarding meaning and doctrine?
Yes. This is a point that becomes more important as the Malamiya developed over the centuries. Originally, it was a very inward-turning movement. Later, during the Ottoman period, it became a social movement and, to some degree, even a political one. And later, by the turn of the 19th century, and as Ottoman Turkey began to move towards becoming a republic, which occurred in the 1920s, many of the Malamatis welcomed secularization and democratization, in other words, the modern form of the republic, as a substitute for monarchies. Why? So that people would be liberated to act self-responsibly. So in doing so, that is, in acting more self-responsibly, there was a necessity for people to individuate away from collective norms that have become habitual. And these, the Malamati or the Malamiya, I have to use both phrases, by the way, I mean both terms, because they're used interchangeably, were critical of dogmatic fixation and of merely acquired knowledge that had no experiential base. So the later Malamatis, one of whom I studied with for quite some time, emphasized the need to approach scripture and scriptural study from what we would call in academia a hermeneutical approach, one that's flexible in interpretation, and one which allows for multiple interpretations rather than fixed dogma.
Now, when you say the collective norms becoming habitual, that we can believe a set of, you know, doctrinary beliefs, we just live them, we don't really consider them anymore. We just do these things, and
that's
we
right.
don't
they
grow. Is that what you mean by the dogmatic part of
yes.
that?
Yes. Prayer, for example. Prayer becomes, can become, and often does become, an imitative behavior. One doesn't know why one is praying. One doesn't inquire into the why and wherefore and how does it land in me, so to speak.
Right.
It becomes routinized. It becomes something that's socially pressured, that's socially expected. And so we conform to the norm, often, unfortunately, unthinkingly.
Yeah.
And this, the Malamati perspective, is very much against.
Yes. Well, I think, you know, there's a place where people can feel comforted by having sort of, you know, these things nailed down, as it were, or in a box. That when we all say the same thing at the same time in a service, that yeah, there is value to that. But also at the same time, there could also be an end, that when the service is done, it's done. And
correct.
And people leave. And of course, there's a great reaction toward dogmatic beliefs in general in the West, in the Catholic or Christian background that I've experienced. That at some point, people throw out the whole thing when they come up against some point of disagreement or disappointment, or as I have said, throwing out the baby Jesus with the bathwater. And you're, opening up a way of addressing that through mysticism.
There are two sayings of the Prophet Muhammad that are taken very seriously by Malamatis. And these sayings are as follows. A prayer without presence of the heart is invalid. That's the first saying. The second saying is prayer without knowledge is invalid. So presence of the heart and knowledge, knowing why one is praying, investigating why one is praying, are very important to the Malamatis. It's right at the core of Islam. And one finds it in the Quran. What one finds in the Quran, if one reads it carefully, is that the Quran admonishes people to use their intellect, their akal, and to think.
About what they're doing,
how it's relevant, whether they're present to what they're doing, and whether they're awake to what they're doing,
or whether it's routine.
Correct.
Yes.
Whether it's simply become a habit.
Well, that's interesting, because in the Muslim world, you would be praying five times a day.
That's right.
You just need to connect with that heart, the Sufi, the wool, the soft heart. For that to be valid? Is that what you're...
To be present, to pray with presence of the heart means to make oneself available to the presencing of God, to be in a state of relaxed yet vigilant awareness and expectancy, to place oneself in that position, and to cultivate that way of being.
That just made me smile when you said expectancy. There's joy in that.
Oh, yes.
There's joy. And that's also something we don't tend to not talk about quite as much. But so then getting back to meaning then, focusing on values, let's say, rather than just specific beliefs, how would we make meaning? Where is the greatest meaning?
Well, to begin with, I have problems with the word spirituality often, because what attends that word are associations of something ethereal, therefore ephemeral, something outside of life.
Yes.
In the Malamati way, spirituality is something that's spirited, that brings a sense of vitality to one's life and immediacy. And moreover, spirituality must become grounded in the everyday world or the mundane world to be efficacious, to actually function. So therefore, spirituality is not, it's not approached as something otherworldly, but very much embedded in the world, in existence, and available to us as we confront existence.
And that's such an important point that you're making, that yes, that the answer is not necessarily out there, because if God permeates everything, then God is right here.
Correct.
Inside
Absolutely.
Us on this earth.
Right. Yes. The dualistic barriers that we often create between ourselves and God, and between that which is spiritual and the mundane world, are actually impediments. And the Malamati path attempts to dissolve those dualistic barriers so that one can come to the state of perception in which one sees the unity that pervades all of existence in all of its aspects.
Thank you very much, Dr. Tusselis, for that answer. We're about halfway through the program right now, and in the next part, I'd like to, we're going to get into some discussion about spiritual maturity that I'm looking forward to, but right now, we're just going to take a short break. You are listening to the Godspeed Institute live on the Progressive Radio Network in New York City. We're going to take a short break, but afterward we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Yannis Tusselis, director of Itlach Foundation and author of Sufism and the Way of Blame. Let's spend a couple of minutes now with a familiar voice. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute, live on the Progressive Radio Network in New York City. I'm your host, Carol Hallenbeck, and that was a little of With a Child's Heart, featuring a very young Michael Jackson in the fellowship of his brothers. We're talking with Dr. Yannis Tusselis today, director of Itlach Foundation and author of Sufism and the Way of Blame. Now, Dr. I'd like to go back to some of what we were talking about before the break. We were heading into the focus on values rather than a stagnant doctrine belief system, and the topic of growth, spiritual growth, which would point toward how we become mature spiritually. The kind of thoughts we have as young people that progress as we mature, and the question: if our spirituality progresses as we grow, and all other things change with us, does our image of God also change?
Absolutely. There have been studies done at Emory University by. I'm hoping I remember his name correctly, James Fowler, the theologian.
I believe
on,
so.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. On faith as a developmental process. So our images of God, of the ineffable, of the sublime, change as we mature from static to more fluid concepts, as found by Fowler. And that change in God concept also, according to Fowler, accompanies our moral development. So the structures of our moral psychology, you could say, change over time, as long as we're progressing, as long as we're maturing, as do our images of what God is or may be. These two things seem to parallel each other, these two facets of life, moral development and our concept of God.
Now, I find that, for example, with children, with small children, and I can refer to my own, one of my children used to see a feather when she was like 2 years old and say, "Oh, look, God is here."
Yeah.
Because she saw God in feathers in particular. And then as she became older and more instructed in the ways of the, you know, the world, the religious world as well, her image then began to change to, you know, God as an old man kind of figure.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm seeing we're moving away from that again, opening up the possibility of change without fear, because I think this is what we get into when we talk about doctrine,
mm-hmm.
that
yes.
we need to adhere to this or we're going off track, and if we're going off track, there's some kind of ramification.
Right.
For us. So the idea of playing almost with these, you know, beautiful, delicious ideas of the infinite, you know, some people might even question even starting going in that direction. Can you address that in relation to doctrine and doctrinal beliefs?
Yeah, I believe I can. There's a map that the Malamatis adhere to that's a developmental map, and it goes like this. I'll try to keep it brief.
I'll take your time.
The first stage of human development is based on what Sufis call the commanding self, a largely impulsive, sensate-based sense of the self that focuses on its self-survival or on survival. It's largely power-driven, instinctive, reflexive, perhaps even unthinking. The second stage of our development is based upon what Sufis call the blaming sense of self, or the blaming nafs, which is a conscientious sense of self, the development of conscience, one could say. And you can see this in child development. The third stage is what Sufis call the inspired sense of self, or the inspired nafs. And this is a form of self that's open to both intuition and inspiration, and third of all, creative exploration. The fourth stage of development is based on tranquility, on becoming self-possessed, on becoming confident of one's own powers of discrimination and insight. And if all four stages of the self have been completed, then there's the possibility of what Abraham Maslow once called self-actualization, becoming all that one can be, beyond which one is compelled to transcend the self altogether.
Hmm.
I found a great correspondence between Abraham Maslow's stages of development and those that are embedded in the classical Sufi system. And it was a rather surprising parallel when I first came upon it. And then it made complete sense that if one is given what one needs, that is a sense of safety, of security, of basic self-survival, of what Eric Erickson calls basic trust in the world early in one's life, then it becomes easier to make these transitions to arrive at a fullness of human being. And a fullness which at the same time calls for an opening to being itself, to existence itself. And by existence, I mean not just manifest creation, but the forces that brought being into being. And so along with all these changes, there are corresponding changes in one's concept of God. Early in one's life as a child, one may view God as an authoritative figure, sort of a composite of all the authority figures in one's life, including one's parents, one's teachers, etc. A judging God also. A God that tells us, do this, don't do that.
Right.
Yeah. Malamatis considered this to be something inevitable, but something that occurs much earlier in spiritual development and something which needs to be gradually surpassed. So
yes.
that one begins to view God, the infinite, the sublime, whatever name you want to put to it, as the creative force that's working within the entire universe, as a presence, an awakened presence that resides at the heart of life.
Yes, and that makes sense because of course many people work with that idea of God of almost like a childhood idea of God as a punishing or rewarding parent.
Correct.
And it might stay there, and so we can deprive ourselves of allowing that image. It may not even be aware of it that there may be another further growth and development with that image and relationship with God. Now, you say that existence, you mentioned earlier, unified and non-dual in nature. It's not an inner-outer experience, but an interrelational field suffused by this awareness. And also, there's recognition, where you say that most, if not all, human beings have the ability to recognize that they themselves are a part of this being as well. Can you speak to that point? Because it really touches on what you were just saying about even an initial sense of safety in life.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Yeah. The word itlock, which we employ, has the meaning of liberation attached to it. Liberation or an emancipation of the intuitive capacity that inheres in all human beings. That's what we seek to free. That's the direct connect with what we've been talking about. The function of intuition. And as it matures, it becomes the function of gnosis, of being able to directly perceive, not through belief, but through perception itself, being is infused or suffused with a form of intelligence that goes beyond ourselves, that goes beyond our own form of limited intelligence. So the purpose in our work is to find where it is that we're fixated, find where it is that we've become fixed in a particular concept of ourselves and of God, investigate that fixation, relax it, and move beyond. And as we do that, our reading of scripture, and for the Sufi, the scripture, the paramount scriptures, the Quran, changes so that the Quran itself becomes a different kind of book for people at different stages of development. Within Sufism, there's this idea that revelation itself is not fixed. It's not entombed in a particular prophet or scripture, though it's greatly represented in the Quran for most Sufis. It's not fixed there. Revelation is something that's ongoing, that we can participate in through our own inspiration, through the activation of our own inherent intuition.
And the term fixed, as in any form of a belief or particular ideological or whatever component, is an obstruction?
Yes.
And this would be something that could obstruct or even distort our perception?
And we see that all the time. Secularists have a problem with religion, understandably, because the type of religion that they confront quite often is a doctrinaire or dogmatic form of religion which does not admit to further inquiry. That form of religious life believes that it has captured the absolute in thought, that it owns the absolute. And so each of the ways can degenerate into polemical stances of one sort or another that rest on the belief that they and they alone know the truth. And from the Malamati perspective, there are multiple truths which arise and fall within the flux of life.
Now, would that mean that historically, has there been ever any conflict within the tradition between, say, the Sufi school and other Islamic groups?
Always.
Always?
Yes, always.
Short answer.
Some of the great early Sufis became martyrs. Mm. They were considered freethinkers and therefore heretics and were put to death. Today, this continues. In many Islamic areas of the world, there's a tension between Sufis and legalists that continue, and fundamentalists that continues to this day, Afghanistan being a prime example. The Taliban has put to death Sufis. They're an anti-Sufi movement. They want to freeze Islam in a very narrow set of parameters their own. And they don't admit to the possibility of a multiplicity of interpretations and of ways of being Muslim.
Hmm. Yes, I'm afraid that happens in other traditions as well.
Now, I would say it's happened historically in all traditions.
Yeah.
Whether Christian or even Buddhist, although Buddhists tend to be viewed as pacific,
right.
There were times in Buddhist history. For example, in Tibet, when the Bonpo were persecuted for their beliefs, and people died because of those persecutions. So this is a very dangerous aspect that attends organized religion, a type of authoritarianism, which the Malamati believes is a falsification of original Islam.
Thank you very much, Doctor, for that answer. Now, you conducted some personal research in doing your book with apparently one of the last living representatives of the Way of Blame in Turkey today?
Correct.
Can you share a little bit about that experience?
Yeah. I was fortunate to meet, his name is Mehmet Selim Özic. In 1995, after I'd already been on the Sufi path for a number of years. And Mehmet Selim is one of perhaps five still active teachers in this tradition in Turkey. And he's a very unassuming man. One wouldn't even notice him in a crowd. He doesn't stick out. He doesn't have any visible charisma, as it were. And people often don't read him as a particularly spiritual person. They read him as a gentle old man who may even be boring.
Then he's done well.
Yeah, he's done quite well.
Right.
He does not seek public attention. He was rather hesitant to be named, for example, in this work. He's not interested in followers or adherents. He abhors missionary activity of any kind, etc., etc. He simply wants to be available to those who can understand him. We had an immediate rapport when we met, and on the basis of that spiritual friendship, I became a murid or a student of his. And what he did for me was he helped me to discard what was less essential to the Sufi path. And I should say, by that point, I had become formally a sheikh in one of the Sufi orders.
Yes.
He encouraged me to let go of that structure as less pliable, as less applicable, and as less relevant to the surroundings I live in. I live in the Bay Area, California. I live in the modern world. Yes. I don't need to take on all the accoutrements of Sufism. What I needed to do, according to Mehmet Selim, was to turn inward and to discover the essentials of what it meant to be on a Sufi path.
Hmm.
And he helped me to do that over a number of years and became my closest friend and spiritual father.
That's very moving. And it must have been quite an honor to be able to not just interact with him, but to also to write this book.
Well, when I ask myself, why did I write this book in the first place? I've asked myself many times. I was hesitant to write it, to be honest. So I thought, well...
Why?
To whom will this book address itself? Who's really there for this book? There are enough books on Sufism as it is. Is this just going to be another one of those books? These were the kinds of questions that came up in me. First of all, second of all, does the tradition itself want to be publicized? It never has wanted to be publicized. It's something that one meets up with through face-to-face, person-to-person encounter, if that's meant to be.
Yeah.
So, as I thought about this book, I thought, well, I'm not really up for writing it, but I feel a responsibility. I feel compelled to write this book because of my responsibility to these people with whom I feel a very close personal connection. People who have not been noticed. People who take a different approach to Sufism than most. People who approach Islam as a whole quite differently from what we hear in the news all the time. So I thought this voice needs to be heard because it adds to the complexity of the picture of Islam and what's capable or what's possible within the Islamic tradition.
Thank you. Now, you have also said that a relational life depends upon dialogue. And that dialogical understanding can only occur through a well-grounded approach to ethical relationship, I'm quoting now, which encourages mutual responsibility, openness, presence, and trust.
Yeah.
Now, for all of us, not only, you know, in the Middle East, but also in this rather secular West, how does this apply to groups of people and to tolerance going forward?
I think very directly, very necessarily, it applies to all of us. As we undergo the process of spiritual maturation, as we become adults, we have to have an adult approach to spirituality, one that requires us to be self-responsible, one that requires us to be in a state of self-reckoning, of moral adjustments, of applying a situationalist kind of ethics, not a fixed dogmatic form of ethics, of, in short, developing ethical reflection in a nuanced way. That's what's required of us to become, according to Malamati's, fully completed human beings. How does this apply? It means that we have to cultivate deeply personal relationships with each other, whether within a family structure, within our immediate surroundings, through our friendships. It means that we have to approach each other in an open way that at the same time calls us each to be self-responsible in a reciprocal way. So the paradigm that I would apply to this is the paradigm of the Malamati teacher is one of spiritual friendship, not of being an exalted sheikh or guru of some kind who pontificates, who hands down either the teaching or a blessing of some sort that's imbibed by passive recipients, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But rather people who are journeying together and who are intensely investigating the quality of the journey.
Thank you so much. Doctor, as we come to the toward the end of the program, I wanted to ask you, if people want to learn more about your work, where should they go?
We're in the process of building a website right now. It does exist on the Internet. The portal is there. The rest will come. They can contact me through itlockfoundation.com. itlakfoundation.com.
And that's I-T-L-A-Q
.com. Foundation.com.
Foundation.com.
I'll receive the mail and I'll respond to them individually. And within the next month or two, we should have an active website that will inform people more about our activities.
Very good, and I'll be sure to post that as well on our website so folks can follow you. And for now, if they want to find your book, where can that be located?
Simple enough. They can go to Amazon.com. They can look under Sufism and the Path of Blame or my name, and it pops up. It's published by Quest Publications. They can either order it through Quest Books, which is the Theosophical Publishing Company, or directly through Amazon.
Well, thank you again, Dr. Yanis Tousalis, for a wonderful hour and a great conversation. I hope perhaps we can speak again in the future.
I do, too, and thank you.
Thank you, and best of luck. Now, before we close today, I would like to just offer a tip for your spiritual tool belt that you wrap around yourself each day. My daughter was born with a full head of hair, thick, spiky, and streaked like a swimmer's. And then, like a mysterious little bird molting, her hair fell out when she was about 2 months old. And soon her new growth began to come in. Beautiful baby hair, all colors of blonde, golden, reddish, brownish, lovely. I could see God's hand on her, the author of her perfect tiny self, the master craftsman of a unique creation, from her little sleepy head to her new toes curled like baby shrimp. I could not, and still cannot all these years later, imagine changing a thing about her. Yet in my life, I had been tempted to change so many things about myself. My hair color, my eye color, even my features. I think after so many years of television commercials and magazine advertisements, I had forgotten that the same masterful hand of God was upon me. My baby's eyes, like mine, made their journey from blue to green at a year old. And when she went through this change, I gazed at her with smiles and wonder. Her eyes are green, not emerald green or sea green or evergreen like the popular contact lenses, just green and perfect. Awakened, I recalled what true beauty really is. It is not a message from the media or schools or peers or friends or enemies. It is the nature and design of life, the life that binds us all. So each day as you step over the threshold of your door and into the world, remember that the same author of life has designed you with the same attention to detail. You are beautiful just as you are, beloved, eternal, and wanted. Thank you for joining us for the Godspeed Institute today. This show was recorded live on the Progressive Radio Network in New York City, engineered by Myron Bitts, and produced by Michael Hallenbeck. If you would like to hear this or any of our previous programs again, or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com. Please send us your comments. We love to receive them at contact@GodspeedInstitute.com. And join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Until then, we wish you Godspeed on your journey.